This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and, yes, women sometimes who have some pretty impressive stories to tell about the things they've done for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, we learn things that we had never even imagined, and I know that's going to be the case today. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a young man today who's not quite 89 years old in Fresno, California, Charlie Wadhams, originally from Brockport, New York. You talk about two different climate extremes. Here we are in the summer in Central California. That's a pretty different weather than you had growing up in upstate New York, huh?
You better believe it. Yeah, and I don't miss it a bit. I came out here and I've done a lot of skiing up in the Sierras, but I don't think I've ever had to wear more than a nice sweater.
And you've never had to shovel snow?
Never had to shovel snow.
Something tells me back in Brockport, maybe you did have to shovel snow once or twice. What can you tell us about your childhood there? What was life like there in the 30s and 40s?
Well, I lived in a small farming community. I would say 8 or 10,000 people. I mean, a small high school. We had a state teacher's college there. I actually went to college for 8 years before I went to high school.
How'd you pull that off? You know, I've had hundreds of veterans, and no one's ever said they went to college for 8 years. Did you say before you graduated high school?
Before I went to high school.
There's got to be a story there. What's the story?
The story is that the teaching college had a demonstration school. So each of our classroom teachers, my first grade teacher was an assistant professor of education. Each of my classroom teachers up through the eighth grade they were all professors. We could unhinge a student teacher in about 4 minutes.
What other things did you spend your childhood doing? And were you aware? Was the depression something that was palpable for you?
It was very present all over town, all over our lives. My dad was a manager of a canning factory. It was part of A&P. Remember mm-hmm. the grocery stores?
Yeah.
They canned all kinds of vegetables. We were a farming community. I mean, there was a much like Fresno in terms of the agricultural work being very important. People had tough times, but there the churches took care of everybody. Mm. I mean, you know, we didn't have the social programs like they have today. We at one time had a few guys and families that were very bad news. One guy got convicted of murder, sent to Sing Sing, you know. I mean, all of that was there, but it was people taking care of each other. Hmm. And so, yes, we were very aware of it.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters, and they still survive. My oldest sister, Pat, is 92, and my next is Janie, who's 90.
So you were the baby. You had those two sisters looking out for you.
And giving me orders, even today.
Even today. I love it. Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a 14, 15-year-old, what kind of ambitions you had back then?
When I was in high school, my father had been a friend of a fellow known as Birdseye. And Birdseye was the guy who invented frozen foods.
Right.
Started fast freezing things in a cold storage. Sometimes I would work in the canning factory or go then other times across the tracks in the freezing plants. And there was an engineer who built these refrigeration units to freeze the peas, you know, the 12-ounce packages you get in the grocery stores. We were doing all that. This guy was a refrigeration engineer, and he was my big hero. And so when I went into the Navy, they asked me what I wanted to do. I said, I'm going to go to college and be a refrigeration engineer. Mm-hmm. So when I enlisted, they give you all these tests and whatnot. They said, yes, you do okay at mechanics and things, so we're going to send you to New Orleans to be a machinist mate. I came home from boot camp. The day that I left, I said goodbye to my dad. He dropped me off the railroad station, and he said, "So long, I'll see you next weekend." I said, "Yeah, probably I'll get leave," and so forth. I went back to Sampson, and 2 days later, they put me on a train. And I didn't go to mechanical school. I went to San Diego to the amphibious training base.
And how long was it till you saw your father again?
2 years.
Yeah, so much for next weekend.
Yeah.
Let me take you back to before that. Because there's a question I like to ask every veteran I have on the show, because without exception, everybody has a memory of a specific day. And I know you would have been just 15 years old, but I imagine it still left an impression on you. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
I was in a movie theater in Rochester. They stopped the movie and said Pearl Harbor's been attacked. And then there was a mad scramble, people joining the services. And in our town, there was a great impact on the school system because some of these big farm guys, they didn't pay any attention to their studies. They just waiting to go into the service. So the discipline was pretty bad. My dad and my best friend next door's father decided to get these kids out of there. So for our senior year in high school, we were both sent away. And he went to a military school in Niagara Falls, and I went to a school called Mount Hermon in Massachusetts. It's like being sent to some sort of a prison. You know, if you're running a school with 600 boys, you've got to have a lot of rules.
Sure. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of chaos, huh?
Yeah, you've got to have a lot of chaos.
Did that toughen you up a little bit for the Navy?
Yes, it did. You had to be independent. You had to get along. Probably the greatest thing was there was a guy I hated who was my English professor, and darn, he taught me how to write.
You have a little more perspective on it now than you had then, huh?
Well, yes, I'm softer in my attitudes for all that we had to do.
When did you decide to join the Navy, and why?
It was automatic that I go in the service. Nobody had any great debate about the social values of being in the military. Everybody just did it. My father had been in the Army with the New York 27th Division, had fought with the Belgians in World War I. He was in a machine gun battalion, and at that time it was a brand new weapon.
Yeah.
And they sent him to school, so he was a sergeant instructor in machine gunnery, and then they sent him to OCS. Fun part of it, that one was he graduated from OCS on November 11th, 1918, and they never gave him his second lieutenant.
Because the armistice was signed?
Because it was over now, we don't need any more lieutenants. And he was in this group called the New York Guard. When the National Guard moves out, the New York Guard moved in, and he would take me out with them, and some of his sergeants taught me how to shoot.
So as a boy, you're exposed, because your father's in the Guard, you're exposed to all this military
stuff. I knew
stuff.
The manual of arms before I went to boot camp.
Well, why didn't you join the Army then?
Last thing my father said was, "Charlie, I spent a year and a half over there," and he said, "I lived in the mud all the time." That's what dugouts and trenches were all about. And he says, "Go in the Navy and get on a ship. You got a warm, dry bunk there every night." And he said, "If it's not there, it's all over anyhow." Incidentally, that brings out the point that every kid who's 17 or 18 years old thinks himself immortal anyhow, so that just went over your head.
How old were you when you signed up?
Well, I was 17.
Mm-hmm. And you told us the story of saying goodbye to your father at the train station, expecting to see him shortly, but not seeing him for 2 years, and they shipped you all the way out here to San Diego for training. What are the things you remember about those training days, and what did amphibious training consist of way back then?
San Diego's amphibious training base, and the training then, a fair amount of it was precursor to what the SEALs are getting today. There were two basic groups there. One group was called UDT, the Underwater Demolition Teams, and the other were the boat crews.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trained in a lot of combat. We had to learn how to shoot all of our own equipment and a number of foreign weapons. Because if you got on the beach and your boat got busted up, what you've got to do is pick up what you've got in your boat. Or we had two 30 caliber machine guns on the back end of the boat, but you can't carry them off. So we would be trained to pick up any kind of a weapon we could get our hands on and go help.
And the boat you're talking about, these are Higgins boats, LCVPs?
Yeah, Higgins made them and Chris Craft made them too.
Did that feel like a pretty secure craft to you? Did it feel like a bit of a vulnerable position? How'd you feel about that piece of equipment?
It really was a pretty secure craft. I mean, yeah. They were built tough as can be. They weighed 9 tons, and you had a 400 diesel engine in there. We would go out every day from the boat pool inside of San Diego Bay and then go out past Point Loma into the ocean and come in and make our landings. And we practiced doing that a lot. When the waves got higher than 8 or 9 feet, you sometimes had a riptide, and you had to learn how to handle a boat with all that stuff, because if you didn't do it exactly right, the boat would broach. And even in training, we lost one guy because the boat rolled over.
I mean,
9 tons of boat rolling around is a lot of. And then they had one of those big things they call a Jahimi, that they could roll it into the water and pick up a boat and straighten it out and send you back.
Most of the people listening, I'm imagining, have never been on an LCVP. I'm sure they've seen pictures and film of them at Normandy on June 6th. And
that's a famous picture. I know exactly what.
Yeah, so that people maybe are familiar with that, but most people haven't been on one, wouldn't be familiar with how they operated. So how many guys would make up a crew?
We started out with 4-man crews, and they would have the coxswain and an engineer and what they call a bow hook and a signalman. And the bow hook and the signalman, when you're making a landing, they'd have the 2 machine guns behind you. As coxswain, the controls were relatively simple. Anybody who's run a diesel, you know, punch the button and start it. And then it had a spade handle, which was the accelerator or forward and reverse. So the whole thing, it was just one thing. The boats, depending upon who built them, had a flat steering wheel. It actually had a screw thing on it where you could extend it up high and screw it down so that you could, under certain circumstances, you wanted to stand up higher so you could see better. When you're getting shot at, that's not a good idea. You know?
I would think not.
I never remember having that steering wheel up high. So, and then some of the other boats had a regular kind of Navy handle steering wheel that was vertical.
And that was your job, was coxswain?
Yes. When we got to the ATB, we were put into a boat group. And some officers came and joined with us, and we were a boat group, and we stayed together for the rest of the war. So our crews were put together there. There were about 125 people in the boat crew. Our skipper was a lieutenant whose name was Comback. Ultimately, he wound up being a professor of physics at Monterey, I call it Canoe U West, the Navy postgraduate school at Monterey.
So when was that you went aboard that ship, the Brookings, and headed out to sea?
The 1st of January, 1945.
And there's still plenty to happen in the Pacific.
Yeah, we went right out.
Do you remember being excited about what was ahead? A little nervous, anxious, scared? What kind of emotions were going through that young man's mind?
I had a duty for several months as a captain's messenger. The captain always has a kid following around with him, and he'd say, get me the gunnery officer, or get me so-and-so, or get me some-so. A seaman, usually the lowest guy in the bunch, got that duty for a while, and every 2 or 3 months, they'd shift, get a new kid in there. The captain was from New York City, and he decided he liked me. He was not well-liked on that ship, so people called me awful names all the time. But one upside of all this is, when he'd go off the ship, and we'd have Liberty in San Francisco, for example, he had a girlfriend, and he took me along to drive his Jeep for him. And so I'd drive around, and he'd say, I'm going up here, and I'll be with her until 10:30, 11 o'clock, pick me up, we'll go back. And at times I drove the captain's gig, which is a different shape landing craft. It's one of those ones that does not have a ramp on it.
Right.
And they put a cabin on it, so it looks like a cruiser. I drove that for him at various times, and I just sort of had a good life with that kind of stuff, and I loved the boats. One day, I was driving him, and he went up to the San Francisco's Civic Center. The commandant of the Naval District was there. He got his orders for going overseas. And then they gave him an intelligence briefing. So he came down and got in the Jeep, and I'm driving back down to the waterfront, and he is really in a state. Well, this time we took off, and they'd loaded a lot of ammunition. We were going basically empty to Pearl. What they did was they loaded a lot of bombs and depth charges in our ship. A transport can't take many, but it was 2,500 tons of it. He was scared to death because there was one or two unidentified subs in our track. And nobody would go near us. I mean, we can't, when you're hauling ammunition, you go alone. Mm-hmm. And he was just absolutely scared to death.
Because you guys were essentially a floating bomb ready to go off.
You're on a floating bomb. And yeah. So I kind of got all upset about it myself.
Well, but is that something that he was trying to conceal from the crew or not make everyone else worry about it, but yeah. You were privy to because of your connection?
That's exactly right.
So that had to be a burden on you as an 18-year-old.
Yeah. Well, what happened is we went to sea and I got seasick for 4 days. And
so you had bigger concerns.
I was really seasick, and I didn't give a damn. I was hoping we'd get blown up, man.
That puts it in perspective.
I can look back on it. Incidentally, I got seasick that once, and for the rest of the time, I never got seasick again.
We were all wondering, weren't we? Time for our first break, but there's so much more to come. The things Charlie Wadhams witnessed in World War II, the mind-blowing top-secret developments he had to keep secret during the Korean War, and some emotional family moments 70 years ago and just in the past year. You'll be able to feel it, trust me. And speaking of family moments and veteran stories, you may have heard about the Vietnam War-themed film Faith of Our Fathers out in theaters. I haven't seen it yet, but I might soon because the film will be where I live in Fresno, California through August 20th. And the reason I'm bringing it up is veterans, military families, and veteran caregivers and their families can all see it for free. It's showing daily at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. through August 20th. And the free vouchers for Faith of Our Fathers are available at VA centers, at Break the Barriers, or by calling Rob Carter at this number, 559-269-5654. I don't normally make announcements like that, but since they're making it free for you veterans, I wanted to let you know. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to get a look at Charlie Wadhams, who joined the Navy at age 17 and when we left off had been deployed with an LCVP boat crew aboard the USS Brookings in the Pacific. Like so many of the vets you hear on this program, he has a very humble attitude about his service to our country.
I'm not a big hero. I was never in a first wave. We were due to go to Japan in October, but that didn't happen. But we took the 52nd Seabee. They went into Okinawa to build some airfields on the north end of Okinawa. And all the action was going on down in the mountains in the south. We did go into Buckner Bay, or we renamed it Buckner Bay on the east side.
Yeah. Well, what kinds of things did you see there?
From the beach, we couldn't see a lot of the destruction. Other places, it was much more evident, like Saipan and Iwo Jima, where a lot of the action had taken place right on the beach. Okinawa, they let us come ashore. But the other landings, you had terrible destruction on the beaches. You go in there, and there are landing craft, those ducks, you know, the big marine things. They'd picked up most of the bodies by the time we got there. And so you didn't see that, but there was just destruction all over the place. I mean, it was really terrible.
You know, I've talked to guys who had your role at Iwo Jima, of taking an LCVP in, trying to get guys off, which was really tough because of the tides there, because of the volcanic sand on the beaches there. And they're doing all this while the fire is coming in and guys are getting mowed down. And I imagine for you, when you get there and you're describing some of the aftermath that was visible there, does the thought occur to you, boy, a couple months ago, that could have been me?
Yeah. Well, you bring up a couple of points. Number one, a real trick in driving a landing craft is getting off. And you've got to be extremely careful with the position of your rudder, because if it's not centered, you first start on a wave and go a little ways, and then you got no water, and the next wave comes in and picks you up, and you back out with that. If your rudder isn't straight at that time, it'll bend it. And once you've got a bent rudder, you're all over. I mean, you can't get the boat off, because and a rescue boat may come and pull you off, but with that, you're out of action. And you got to be pretty damn careful, because you don't want to be out of action. So that's really a dangerous time.
And it's not just you that you're responsible for.
No, you could be. We're trained because we got to be able to get that boat off there loaded. Because as soon as you get the troops on the beach, you may be taking casualties back.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the APA is designed to do.
Right. With your LCVP, you didn't have to evacuate wounded. You didn't have to take guys in for that first wave when things were hot and heavy. But you did get shot at.
Well, everybody did a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
it still doesn't feel good.
Well, I just remember a few times, again, along the beach, we were maybe too close to the shore, and you hear some zing zings, and you say, thank God I heard him, because it's someone you don't hear that's get you.
But what do you do when that begins, when you realize that there are bullets flying and they're heading in your general direction?
Well, first of all, you get down. You got some armor plate along the side of that thing that's okay for 25 and 30 caliber, but you're going to get in trouble if they're hitting you with 50s and 20 millimeters.
A lot of Marines lost their lives at Iwo Jima, at Saipan, even a few at Tinian. Certainly, Okinawa's a bloody, bloody situation.
Oh, yeah.
And at one point or another, you were at all of those places, and you described seeing some of the aftermath. Did it hit you as a teenager at how great a price was being paid and how big this whole thing was?
Yeah. You really didn't have to think about it. It was just simply there. Later on, after the war, our squadron, which was 26 ships, 22... APAs and 4 AKs. We picked up the 6th Marine Division and took them to China. Immediately after, we went to Tokyo for the surrender, and then we took the 43rd Army Division from Manila to, we put them over the docks at Yokohama, then shortly left and went right down to Guam, and we picked up Marines. And pretty soon at Guam, we'd assembled the whole division, and then we took off to Tsingtao, China.
You mentioned getting to Okinawa. Well, it was the latter half of the battle, but the battle's still going on there. And throughout that clash over that island, kamikazes were ever present. Just about everyone I've talked to who was there at some point around the coast of Okinawa witnessed some of those. Did you ever see some of that?
Only once. One of them came down, and they looked like they were coming after us, but then they saw a hospital ship which was beyond us, and they went off and hit it. Shortly thereafter, we again saw the hospital ship back at Guam. And I remember two destroyers came in. One of them had the bow chopped off right behind the first turret, and the other one had been flattened. The whole stern was just flat with a water line, and the Lord was good to them, because their driving shafts still worked and they could bring the ships in. Don't know whatever happened to them after that, but it was really quite a sight to see them.
Well, it kind of sounds like the Lord must have been good to you too. I mean, you're doing a duty that was dangerous for a lot of guys. If you're at somewhere else at a different time doing the same job, you might not be here. And then this kamikaze goes past your ship, hits a hospital ship, which had to upset you a little bit, but At least you're still around, huh?
anybody that, who's a gunner at that time, and when I wasn't in a boat, I had a job. I was a 20-millimeter gunner.
So on your ship, this APA, the Brookings, you have all the LCVPs, and when you're making landings, you go off in those. But otherwise, if general quarters sound, you go to this position on a 20-millimeter.
I was a gunner on 21.
And that meant what you're shooting at is enemy aircraft.
Yes. And the only question that you ever have if you're shooting at one of those guys is, why can't this thing shoot faster? I was so scared the first time that they called general quarters, and it was real, that I jumped up from my bunk and ran up to the gun and opened the ready locker, wound up one of the magazines, they have to be cranked up, and loaded the gun and turned on the gun before the next guy got there.
So you did a few people's jobs.
Oh,
you did the whole crew's job.
They all arrived and everything was ready because I was so scared. But it all turned out all right. There are some conversation pieces that came shortly thereafter that I don't think we can say on the air.
Uh-huh. I'm sure you heard a lot of things that you can't repeat. Yeah. Well, and you mentioned how scared you are, and I think people appreciate that candor, and they can imagine themselves as a teenager feeling those same kinds of things. Throughout your whole time in the Navy, was there one moment or incident that got your attention the most, scared you the most, made you feel the most like, hey, I might not see my family again?
I need to turn a corner on this one.
All right.
When we were on the honor flight, sitting there in a big dining room, one of the guys said something about the typhoons.
Mm.
Yes, we went through 5 typhoons in the Pacific Ocean. I think the worst one was about 80 miles east of Okinawa when we were taking the 43rd Army Division to the surrender. Okinawa recently had a typhoon. They were saying this is the worst ever, and they compared it to the one in 45. We rode that one out, and I'll tell you, when your ship goes through one of those waves and goes up and then comes boom, you know, crash, and you look and you see that the two masts are going in opposite directions. You say, this thing, you could tear this thing apart. And there were times in other typhoons when I was on the bridge, the officer of the deck was almost washed overboard. One of the telephone talkers grabbed him and hung on to the rail and hung on to the man so he wouldn't get, because green water came right down on the bridge, which is 40 feet off the water.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking back to earlier when you said, you know, what would you do, when I asked you what you would do when you're in your LCVP and they're firing at you, and you get down, and that's got to be a helpless feeling, not knowing if something's going to hit you or not. But it seems like these typhoons probably felt even more helpless, right?
You were watching almost every wave, you know. Right after that, I was on the bridge because when we took our troops into Yokohama, immediately the Navy left some long-timers, took them right home. So they broke up our boat group as a group, and we were absorbed into ship's crew. At that point, I went up onto the bridge as a quartermaster, so I was a ship driver from then on.
You know, we just marked 70 years since the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and this weekend marks the 70th anniversary of the Japanese surrender. When it comes to the atomic bomb, do you remember hearing about it when it happened?
Oh, of course I do. And I need to set this up for you.
Sure.
As you know, I am 88 years old, and you take away 70 years from that, and I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
3 weeks before my 19th birthday. Do I remember it? You bet your life. And on the 14th, when Japan actually surrendered, I remember Hiroshima. I remember Nagasaki. I even saw Nagasaki a couple of months later. There I was, 18 years old at the time, and exactly when it happened, we were in Giwan, Samar, picking up supplies, getting ready to invade Japan. We went from there to Guam, and we went right down the same track that a week and a half before the Indianapolis had gotten sunk. Mm-hmm. And we went right by the same place, and we didn't know anything about it. I look back on that, and yeah, I remember it dramatically.
And you knew you guys were going to be invading Japan? You were aware that's what your destiny was?
Yeah, they were showing us.
Did you think that was something you could survive, making those landings?
You had no question. again, you were 18 and immortal. I mean, you know, I think you hear people say who got hit, they were surprised it was them.
That said, maybe you have a different answer to this question than a lot of guys that I've talked to, because I've had, you know, certainly scores of veterans who, just like you, were getting ready to invade Japan when it all came to an end. And most of them will say, you know, I'm a big fan of Harry Truman because when he made that decision to drop the bomb, he saved my life. Are you in that camp?
Yeah, I am. And I've argued about it for years and years and years, and I've had some more experience with just that.
Well, you have a very interesting story, I know, that hopefully we can get out of you that relates to that. But so you don't have to invade Japan. And then your ship was there in the harbor, Tokyo, in early September when they signed the surrender?
We came in about 2 days later, but yes, it was
okay. At that time.
Got another typhoon right there, too.
You got to figure out how to dodge those things.
I want to tell you what was, when we put the 43rd over Yokohama, on the pier sticking out, there's a couple of LSTs and a hospital ship. And about halfway through our unloading, like the guys in the boats were walking around on the piers talking to the guys. And a couple of buses pull up and the prisoners of war came out.
Wow.
They looked awful. And, of course, even now, you know, I get emotional about this.
Sure.
But they just looked terrible. And you were comforted. All of us gave them our cigarettes and everything we had on us. And then they got on the hospital ship, and they had big, thick mattresses, and they were going to take care of these guys on the way home. Then another group came through, and they were Australians. And they went to that LST at the end of the pier. And they had to ride that floating cork all the way to Australia. We were mad at our government and the Australian Navy that they didn't have something better up there for those guys to ride home.
Because what you're saying is the Americans, the Australians, they were both prisoners of war in the same kind of camps and both in the same kind of condition.
Probably lived next to each other, yeah. Sure.
Skin and bones. You're talking about guys who were 80 pounds when they should have been 180?
Exactly.
And I'm sure you'd never seen anything like that before.
I'd never seen people like that before. Just awful.
Did it make you angry against the enemy?
Yeah. You see, people would argue about the heinous destruction of the atomic bombs. And I'm saying, no, 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 no. These two bombs caused this country who had stolen a religion and did all this stuff. It's just like it is today. You've got, what's the difference between a kamikaze or a terrorist attack? I mean, they're the same thing. You had this going on where a people under the name of religion would make bonsai attacks, and you've got this going on in the Middle East today. I mean, it really is pretty similar.
And those prisoners of war that you saw, you could see how close to death they were at that point.
Oh, no question.
Without those bombs, good chance a lot of those die in captivity, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not to mention possibly you and all these other guys on an invasion force that would die.
Yeah. You know, we've all read all the stories about operations intelligence that they had for the landing.
Mm.
It winds up that they've got 2 to 3 times as many people with every man, woman, and child coming after us.
And those forecasts expected upwards of 1 million Americans to die and more than that on the Japanese side if that invasion had taken place, which it didn't. And you mentioned something earlier that I want to follow up on. You said 2 months after the second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, you went to that city and saw what was left. What did you see there?
Nothing. Nagasaki's a port city, and we had gone to China, and then we're bringing some troops back to get them home by Christmas. So we went into Sasebo, and Sasebo was just a few miles north of Nagasaki. So they took us out to a hill nearby. We looked down, and there, say 4 or 5 miles away, was what was left. And if you remember the photographs of it, the only thing that is a light pole here and there, and then everything else is just flattened right out.
Did it blow your mind a little bit to realize that something was capable of that destruction?
Oh, yeah.
When it was all over? And you got to come home. You mentioned you didn't see your dad for 2 years when you joked about seeing him the next weekend. What did that feel like to get back and see your family again?
I came back to Brockport. I got off the bus, and he stood there, gave me a big hug, and said, "Thank God you made it." Like many papas at that time, we were on a handshaking basis when I was 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
after that day, we never saw each other without a hug.
Wow. That's powerful. I know your story doesn't end with World War II, but is there anything else that you think people need to know about that time in our history, the guys that you served with, the things that you saw, or why it matters today?
Well, I would just go back to what I just said about the commonality of what you're seeing today in geopolitics and what happened at World War II.
In the savagery of ISIS, you see parallels to Imperial Japan or Nazi Germany?
I do, very much so, yeah.
So what can we learn from the way America and its allies prevailed 70 years ago that can help us now?
On the trip to Washington, the Korean Memorial.
This is your honor flight experience with Central Valley Honor Flight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to answer your question, we were standing there looking at this particular memorial, and so many young teenagers, they were high school kids, came by and shook our hands and said, "Thank you for your service." I decided I've got to give them an answer. And I said, "Are you studying this?" And they all said, "Yes, that's one of the reasons we're here." And I said, "Then you remember what's happened and just darn well never let it happen again. That's what's your job as a citizen."
Mm.
I think that's the only thing we can say. These kids have to know history to realize that we repeat ourselves again and again and again if we don't pay attention to history.
Boy, you said it. That's one of the biggest reasons I've been doing this show for all these years. And I'm sure those young people you met in Washington are not going to forget that encounter. There's also some history you're privy to that I bet most of our listeners are not aware of. It has to do with the possibility of nuclear weapons being used after World War II. When we come back, we'll explore some of the highly sensitive duty Charlie had during the Korean War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Navy veteran Charlie Wadhams of Fresno, California, originally from Brockport, New York. We've heard about his duties piloting LCVPs into Pacific beaches and some of the other things he did aboard ship, the USS Brookings, APA 140. We're going to hear about the fascinating job he had during the Korean War in a moment, and I can almost guarantee you're going to hear something you've never heard before. But first, Charlie, you shared a real poignant story about your interactions with young people while you were in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Honor Flight, of course, is a nationwide effort to get our World War II veterans to their memorial, which wasn't completed till 2004. It's happening everywhere Hometown Heroes is heard, wherever you're listening today. In fact, if you happen to be listening on California's Central Coast today on affiliate KVEC in San Luis Obispo, you can support Honor Flight Central Coast by going to the Crush and Roll West event August 28th and 29th. I've got that linked at hometownheroesradio.com, and the weather should be great, so go for it. That's just an example, but again, it's happening everywhere. And for you, Charlie, as a World War II veteran, how was that honor flight experience?
It was wonderful. There are so many of us who don't have horrendous combat experience, but we're there helping out. And to be thanked for that is really impressive. Everybody's got a story, haven't they?
Amen.
And it's fun to listen to their stories. I got pretty emotional. And several occasions, one at the Iwo Jima Memorial. I wasn't in that battle, really. I came up on it shortly thereafter. But I suppose part of it is because it's beautifully done. But this was the opening experience of this whole thing.
That's the first thing you see. Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, they got my attention. Then to go on at World War II and see the bronzes that depicted the battles of my brothers-in-law, Normandy and the Bastogne, and then to be able to honor my good buddy, who's Rick's dad.
You and I know what you're talking about, but the listeners don't. When you said your good buddy, who was Rick's dad, one of your best friends in the Navy had a son who married your daughter.
That's true.
And that's the son-in-law who went with you, Dr. Rick Geller, who went with you on that honor flight. So how did you and his father get to know each other?
What happened was when I got recalled for Korea, the Navy sent me to the postgraduate school at Monterey, and I was trained in cryptography, codes and ciphers and things like that.
Intriguing.
My class was the first one that had gone through this thing. The guys got assigned to LST Division so-and-so, Destroyer Squadron such-and-such, Port Director Wonsan, Korea. They went and did Incheon. I got orders to the staff of the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. It says, whatever port he may be or wherever he is, I'm going there. We understand it's a large concrete building at Pearl Harbor. I reported in there in December of 50.
In between, you had gone to the University of Rochester and graduated there?
I went to school on the GI Bill.
Met your wife?
I met my wife. I was a year ahead of her, and when the war popped, we had a wedding and a three-week honeymoon. I kissed her goodbye and took off. And
wow.
Just like Papa, isn't it?
Yeah, you got a history. You got a track record here.
Yeah. So when I got to Pearl, I went to work in communications as a top secret watch officer. The guy I was in charge was a lieutenant by the name of Dick Geller. The staff had a thing called a top secret control officer, and then he had four assistants for watch officers. And so I was a watch officer. Incidentally, on that staff, they had five admirals and one ensign. I was the only ensign on the staff. And I got a lot of teasing. I got to know several admirals very well that way. I said, my gosh, Wadhams, are you still an ensign? You know, that kind of thing. So Dick and I went through a lot of experiences together. And we have our own communications. And then the next piece of this is communications intelligence, all that cryptography and all that kind of stuff, heavy duty. We were mixed up in both sides of it. I really didn't get into code busting until later on. The man who broke the Japanese code was our boss. He was Captain Layton, Eddie Layton.
Mm-hmm.
And he and a man by the name of Rochambeau were the guys who broke the Japanese code. And there's that famous story of Midway and all that kind of stuff. That was Layton. Wonderful man.
So they had broken the Japanese code in World War II, which led to big breakthroughs for America. But as you're there in 1950 and onward, what are the kinds of communications or coded things that you had to deal with?
Security says I can't really tell you a lot about it.
Even now? Even 65 now. Years later?
Yeah. When you get into communications intelligence, there is not without specific direction. We don't talk. I can tell you a little piece of this, which was, I don't know whether I'll get criticized for this or not. One of the typical jobs that had to be done in code breaking was weather reports. If you ever seen a weather report, it's a series of maybe 20 numbers for barometric pressure, sea state, what the sky looked like, what's the clouds and wind, da-da-da-da, the whole thing, and it's all stated in a series of numbers. The Fleet Weather Central across the street from us needed to have the reports that were put out by the Russian weather stations. They all put in their weather reports every day, and it's going through all of the Eastern Hemisphere. We'd had to get those and break them and give the reports to our weather people so they, if you're in Korea, the weather's going to come from the west, so you got to have those Russian weather reports.
And that was more than just translating language.
It was code busting, yeah.
The weather was transmitted in code. And did you have a key, a legend for that, or you had to figure out what it was?
We had a method for breaking it, yeah.
And you're saying you can't tell us too much about it because some of those methods are still used?
Well, I think a lot of that stuff today is done automatically by computer. I was ultimately called a specialist in communications intelligence. In other words, I was, by definition, a cryptanalyst. And today, they don't have them anymore. My whole specialty is now called network warfare officer. And that just suggests to you it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, in these days, if the commander-in-chief needs to get a hold of SyncPAC, as it were back then, commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, he can probably pick up a phone and get them that way. That wasn't an option in 1950 and 51 and 52.
Yeah, they were doing it by teletype.
Well, and didn't you have a little involvement in that? If President Truman needed to get a hold of MacArthur and tell him you're fired?
Well, that was another different little thing. But President Truman came to our headquarters on his way out to fire General MacArthur. So we would handle anything he needed, any messages he needed to send. And there was always work to be done. And so we got to see the president on several occasions.
What did you think of him?
I really liked the man. Politically, I was not on the same track as Harry Truman, but I decided I liked him very much. He was an honest, tough man. He was brought up in one of the big political groups in Missouri. When he became president, he was president of the people, not those political groups in Missouri, which is, got to give him credit for
the
that.
The buck stops here, huh? So six admirals and an ensign. Did Harry Truman treat you any differently than the admirals?
Oh, no. All of those people, when you're talking about that level of command, you're talking about gentlemen. I have to go on and say General MacArthur treated me very well.
What were your interactions with him?
Well, after he fired MacArthur, MacArthur came back and stayed in our guest house, and the University of Hawaii gave him a degree. You know, and he was talking about being president, all this kind of stuff. So we gave the same services to MacArthur as we did Truman. And when Truman went to Wake Island, Wake had no cryptographic resources. The only bachelor in our group was Henry Booth. Hank traveled with the president, and when the president wanted to send us a message, he used a so-called one-time pad. This is a spy device. And he'd send the messages to us, and we'd decipher them and re-encode them in machine systems and send them on. So we all got to work fairly closely with the president, yeah.
That's a pretty unique role that you played there.
Kind of fun.
With the lens of history now, we look back and we know that no one has deployed an atomic weapon in combat since August of 1945. But 5 years later, during the Korean War, there was a lot of talk of that. In fact, General MacArthur said he wanted to drop 20, 30, 50 of them all around Korea and make a wall of nuclear wasteland. And Harry Truman had to make that decision. And at one point, he told the American people that option was on the table. What do you know about all that because of where you were and because of Truman being there, relieving MacArthur and everything that happened there? Is there something that you can clue us into?
Yeah. We started a project which was very highly classified, going back and forth, picking targets.
In North Korea?
Projecting the weather patterns, picking targets, identifying where the weapons were and all that kind of stuff. It went on over a two-week period, and finally when the B-29 was in the air, we got a message that said Operation So-and-So, negative, negative, negative. And then in the end it said, this is a drill. The B-29 was over North Korea, loaded, when they said, this is a drill. We never believed it for one cotton-picking minute.
That it was a drill.
But yeah. What the pressure with Dick Geller and Dick and I, when I was on watch and he was someplace else, if, you know, if I was on the afternoon watch at 4 to 12 or midnight to 8, I'd clue him in on anything that had happened during the time. And the two of us lived very, very closely together. We'd go off in a corner and talk, and our wives would say, what's going on with you guys, you know? And, of course, we couldn't say a thing to them.
Did they know that you guys were dealing with sensitive stuff? Or were they completely
in
the dark?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they knew.
They knew.
Yeah. People tease us about it, you know. I go into the code room, and certain messages had indicators in them that says this is top secret. They get one of those things, and they have to get me, come and get me. And he said, you got one of your stuff over there. You know, I would go out and reset the machines the way they and go on and break the message. Then they'd say, what's that? And I'd say, MacArthur wants his lunch. But Harry Truman did say no to dropping an atomic bomb on North Korea. I'm inclined to believe that they couldn't find a concentration of Chinese troops that was big enough to make it worth it. For what it would do to the world situation. The Chinese and North Koreans, when they were pushing Marines down, doing something like that would have to be done very, very carefully, because you got the front of it, you got the troops mixed. You
the know? Collateral and, damage would have
yeah,
been too
collateral
significant.
Collateral damage would, and they were being very careful about collateral damage. I thought President Truman was correct in not doing it at that time.
I want everybody to understand here, because this is pretty significant material that we're dealing with here. The climate is, there's talk of nuclear weapons being used. President Truman's on record saying that that's being considered. There are B-29s that are practicing these runs with dummy bombs that have everything but the fissile material.
No, they had real bombs.
On what you're talking about, but leading up to it. So they've been training, they've been preparing.
Yeah.
But I don't think a lot of people maybe have heard what you're saying right now, that there was actually a B-29 in the air over North Korea, ready on the order to drop a nuclear bomb. And pretty close to point of no return, you get the, what you said, negative, negative, negative. In other words, scrap the mission.
Yeah.
Don't drop the bomb.
Well, they sent a flash message, and a flash message is always coming clear. And they say, Operation so-and-so, negative, negative, negative.
In other words, not even bothering with code? Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
So this flash message, it's not encoded anything. It's so urgent, it has to come through in plain English.
Yeah.
So you don't take the chance of them missing the message.
Yeah, I think I remember that it was plain language. I've never heard of a top secret message being sent flash.
So what we're talking about is pretty significant history. History is the things that happened and also the things that didn't happen. And you talk about a world-changing moment, could have been it right there.
Absolutely.
And President Truman, by not dropping that, certainly had a great impact. But what I want to find out is what that meant to you. What was it like to be you in that situation? I'm sure you're carrying this weight of top secret, of responsibility, of everything you're doing, but to know what was happening in that moment and how the world almost changed in that instant, how did you process that?
Yes, it was significant. I was very much aware that my friend Dick was having a tougher time with it than I was. You know, we were really talking about it, I mean, almost hour by hour. He was a wonderful mentor to me. Yeah, all I have to say to you is, it was a heavy load. We knew what we were doing.
Boy, eye-opening, isn't it? Charlie Wadhams, thank you for serving our country in World War II, the Korean War, still in the reserves throughout the Vietnam era, and what a service you've provided with your heartfelt story today. Every once in a while, it's great to grab a little more perspective, and if you followed along, you know Charlie's best friend in the Navy was Dick Geller, whose son married Charlie's daughter. And we're going to hear from that son-in-law, Dr. Rick Geller, briefly before we close. Rick, can you help us understand what this almost 89-year-old means to you?
Well, Charlie's always been there in my life. For my father, Charlie Wadhams was the friend of a lifetime. The friendship that they forged in the Navy lasted as a very strong friendship to the end of my father's life. And when I was very small and Charlie would come to visit my dad, I never saw my dad laugh and smile and enjoy himself the way he did when Charlie was there. I mean, they brought out the best in each other. I've known Charlie literally since the day I was born, and he's just that kind of friendship. And because he was a lot older, that kind of mentoring that he's given me over the years is incredibly precious. When my dad passed away in 1983, Gene and I were engaged to be married, and my dad died suddenly. It was a real blow to us, but Charlie just sort of stepped in, and when I needed the advice of a father, I got it. Sometimes I wasn't on board with thinking that I needed it, but I got it anyway because Charlie loved me, and he loves to fix things and take care of people. But you know, he's been not just a friend and a father-in-law. Charlie's been a father to me for the last 32 years, and he's just an incredibly special person.
Had your father told you a lot about his own time in the Navy?
No, my father would never speak of his time in the Navy. He told me absolutely nothing about his experience during the Korean conflict. He told me that he was in China during the Second World War, but that's all he ever told me about it. And I asked him why, and he just said, I'd rather not talk about it.
But you've learned quite a bit about your dad through Charlie, I imagine.
Yes.
That you never would have known otherwise.
No, he speaks of my father as a leader and a mentor and a friend. And retrospectively, I can see that in my dad, but Charlie helped me to understand things more fully about my father that were really useful to know. The honor flight itself was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, not just to share it with Charlie, but to meet so many of the other men and women who had served in World War II. The moment that stands out to me in the flight that Charlie and I took together was we brought three stones from California to leave at the World War II Memorial, one each for Charlie's two brother-in-laws who had been in the Army in the European theater. And then we left a stone in the Pacific theater for my father. And then the two of us, two grown men, fell into each other's arms and just sobbed, remembering my dad and what he meant to us. And in that same moment, what we meant to each other.
Well, I know what both of you have shared today means a whole lot to everybody listening. Find a photo of Charlie Wadhams and his son-in-law, Rick Geller, together on their honor flight at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wish we could go on, but we're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time for another opportunity to be reminded through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.